The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi there.
Hello, Janet. Welcome, everyone, to season 4 of The Good Place, the podcast. Janet and I are thrilled to bring you this new episode.
Psych. It's bad, Janet, you fecal flumes.
Guys, why do you keep giving me bad Janet for these intros? I really feel like this is more in good Janet's wheelhouse. Guys, Mark?
They're podcast producers, Michael. They don't care. They'll make you do the most humiliating things imaginable as long as they get their sweet, sweet downloads.
Fine. Let's just keep moving.
This episode is brought to you by Skid Marks.
No, it's not. Let's just start the show.
Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. I play Sean. Today we're talking about Chapter 48, Season 4, Episode 9, The Answer. Written by Dan Schofield, directed by Valeria Migliasi Collins. Michael begins to snap to wake up Chidi. We see a series of Chidi flashbacks from Earth and the afterlife where he searches for the answers of the universe and the answer to who his soulmate is. He spends many lifetimes with Eleanor, and before Michael wipes his memories, he writes himself a note which he gives to Janet. Michael finishes his snap, Chidi wakes up, the gang asks him to devise a new afterlife, and Chidi retrieves his note from Janet. The note reads, "There is no answer, but Eleanor is the answer." My guests today are editor Eric Kisak, co-producer Frank Sackett, and William Jackson Harper, who plays Chidi Onagonye. Will, Frank, and Eric, welcome. Everything is what it is, what it is.
Disco Janet.
Disco Janet. Will, you're joining us via Skype. You're in Atlanta right now working. Can you talk about it?
Yeah. I'm working on the Underground Railroad. It's a limited series for Amazon that is based on the Colson Whitehead novel.
Very nice. Yeah. Probably
identical
in tone and fart jokes to NBC's The Good Place.
Yeah. I mean, it's, when I was saying it was totally different, that was a lie. It's the same show, same thing. It's good. It's really pulling me in some different directions. And so I'm, having to do some real honest work.
That's wonderful. I can't wait to see it. We were, just for the backstory for the lore of it, we were in a van together on the way down to Comic-Con this summer when you got a phone call confirming that you had that you'd been offered this role.
Yeah, which was crazy because it was definitely like one of those, you know, it's like you put things on tape and then you just forget about it because you're just like, all right, you know, like I'm not getting the job.
Right.
Like you never get the job,
never.
You know, until you do.
Well, you should clear your schedule because increasingly you're going to be getting the job.
That's the hope. That's what I'm aiming for.
Frank, what is your job? You're a co-producer. You put out a lot of fires. You do a lot of things that nobody ever knows about.
Yeah. I'm a small part in this, but it kind of gets funneled through me. So I make sure all the media can get the editor's room set up, get all the media can get to them.
Media is like, and I'm not being funny, these are like the data cards that come out of the cameras kind of thing?
The cards go into guy that makes dailies that then makes files that we can use for editorial. We don't work in the high-res files
okay.
When they're cutting. Basically, Eric and Matt we call it offline. They lock the show in offline, and then we go after they're done, and we reassemble the high-res files and
really
color them. And
it's because those files become so big. You know, they shoot now just in such high resolution, with such high frame rates.
We shoot in 4K.
Kind of
what are we shooting?
We usually don't shoot in 4K. We shoot in 1080, but still, it's just the way our machines work. Everything would just get bogged down if we were using like the highest quality material. And I guess I just from like my perspective, I mean, every TV show has someone like Frank. Every movie has someone like Frank. And, you know, the way you can tell, like, the good from the bad is, like, basically how much the editor and the director is aware of what's going on. Mm-hmm. Like, the more they're aware, the badder that person is in the job. Because they you from our perspective, I mean, Frank is so good at his job that, like, literally in our minds, it's gotten to the point after, like, 4 years that we kind of think that, like, we're like, okay, we're good. And we press a button and it goes on the air.
In this episode, we find Eleanor asking Michael to, you know, snappy memory fixie, like give Chidi wake him up, give him his memories back. And Michael says, hey, like there's a lot going on. He lived a whole life, then 802 afterlives, then a second life, then a second afterlife, then a third first afterlife. His mind, Michael says, his psyche is like a giant bowl of M&M peep chili, a nice callback to when Chidi shirtlessly lost his mind.
I went Halloween. That was the character I went as.
You went as shirtless Chidi?
I didn't go shirtless, but I had the shirt. I had the shirt.
Wait, you had the shirt that mentions wine or something?
Yeah.
What does it say?
Who, what, where, wine.
Did you have a screen used?
I'm not sure. Wardrobe was clearing out their room, and it was left there, and I put on a pair of khakis, and I had my horn rim glasses, and I was set. So
Frank Sackett. If
I didn't have chili or the peeps, I couldn't carry that around.
You can go full hog. Yeah.
But I mean, that shirt is iconic.
Yeah.
I need to come and steal stuff. Will, did you walk away with anything choice?
You know what? I got something that comes up later in the season, which we can't talk about.
I'll text you. I'll text you later. Let's talk about the snap. So there's a lot going on. Michael snaps, and effectively this entire episode happens within the framework of that snap, right? All of this goes on in Chidi's mind within this. How did you shoot this? How did you and David Miller and Valeria Collins do it? It's a special piece of equipment, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's something called a phantom camera, which is used in a lot of, everyone loves slow motion. Right.
Everyone loves slow motion. And
that's
a fact.
A universal fact. Yeah. Especially with slow motion of like things that happen really fast, like slowing them. Yeah. You know, so like a balloon popping. Mm-hmm. You know, if you Google balloon popping into YouTube or whatever, you know, you will see slow motion. You'll see a slow motion of a balloon popping, and that is shot in a phantom camera. The phantom camera is the camera that can do the slowest slow motion.
We typically shoot in what, 24 frames?
24 mm-hmm. frames per second. The phantom camera can shoot up to, I believe, like 4,000 frames a second. Yeah. But the funny thing about, and if David Miller was here, he could do a better job of explaining this, but basically the faster the camera is shooting, the more frames per second, the more light there needs to be in the room, because essentially the camera just needs to be sucking up light.
Yeah.
I wish I could explain this more technically, but
you're kind of blowing my mind a little bit. Like if you can exhaust the amount of light by capturing it in small doses.
Exactly. Yeah.
Whoa, I mean,
we all just got trippy. So, so we found out that the amount of light that we had, or that David Miller could like truck into that room was enough that we could safely get away with 960 frames per second. So we shot that in 960 frames per second, which ended up looking pretty. And then actually we halved the speed. So when you're actually shooting, so digitally, so we actually kind of did this sort of like frame morphing thing, which actually looks really good when you do slow motion. So I believe what you're ending up seeing is about like 1900 frames per second.
Wow. Interesting. How many takes of that stuff did you shoot of Manny as Jason spilling his Duval ditch water?
I believe there are like five takes. I mean, it's really hard because essentially what has to happen is everyone, all four people have to do their actions perfectly in sync in a second, you know? So you basically have to get, you know, Janet to kind of raise her hands and put it in
she's in like mid summon, right?
She's mid-summon. Mm-hmm.
She's about to get a. She's asking for a margarita that Eleanor is asking for.
Yeah,
yeah.
Jason is slipping on a marble.
Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh. Eleanor is reacting in surprise at the water being spilled or the margarita being spilled. Not a margarita. What is it?
Ditchwater.
Eleanor is reacting in surprise at the ditchwater being spilled.
It's Midori, coffee, and ditchwater.
Very good.
And Tahani is just kind of like covering her eyes like, I can't watch.
Right.
And so the idea was at like the, you know, 1, 2, 3, go, everyone. Oh, and Michael's snapping. Everyone had to do it at the exact same time.
Yeah.
And that's pretty hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I think it was like the first time everyone was like slightly out of sync, and the second time, and by the fifth time it sort of got close, but I ended up actually having to kind of split the screen and kind of like adjust people slightly so that everyone was doing this thing at the same time.
I could live 1,000 lifetimes and I will never understand how you're able to split the screen with handheld cameras. I mean, this is probably locked down, but I get plenty of rough cuts where I can see somebody's elbow coming in a different frame and there's pattern wallpaper and somehow you make it happen.
It's mostly David Niedenagel, but if you want a crash course in Nuke, just come by anytime. He'll
What's it called?
You.
Nuke?
Nuke, yeah.
That makes sense to me. Will, were you there for the spillings or were you off camera and therefore asleep in your trailer?
Oh, no. I was there. I was there for all five takes, not watching.
Yeah, not watching, right?
Yeah, just hearing it.
We meet a very cute baby. We meet infant Chidi, who from moment one is put into existential crisis by being asked immediately whether he's okay with his own name. I mean, that seems very the writer's room.
Yeah. you know, it's like, I mean, his mind's being blown, like, from the very, very moment that he steps onto this earth. I mean, it's just like, it is just a big mushroom trip as a baby, I imagine. It's just like, what is that?
Yeah.
What is that? Oh, my God. You know, so, I mean, like, the last thing that you need in the middle of a freak out like that is somebody asking questions. You know, it's like, I don't know. It's like, I'm seeing Leaf for the first time. I don't understand what that is. I don't understand what it means. so, you know, like, yeah, of course Chidi got a stomach ache right off the bat because, you know, it feels like, oh, these people are important. They seem to want something from me. But right now I'm outside of a womb and I don't understand what that is about.
Young Chidi is a fascinating convergence. On his desk is an abacus and a calculator, which I think is just a lovely detail. There's a giraffe, which feels like an allusion to other things. His parents' living room has many circles and parallel lines, like the vertical blinds and the hardwood floors are very strident, very strict, very linear. And there's a globe. There's a window air conditioner unit that has to be an allusion to the one that kills Chidi in his original timeline. There's African art everywhere with pattern and recurrence and spirals. There's chevroned fabric on the dining set chairs, like the U of M and Princeton fabric from the chaos sequences. The power outlets are not one that I know. I assume it's period accurate, 1991 Senegal. Chidi's father's reading a newspaper in French that mentions Saddam Hussein. Chidi's mother's blouse has acorns and oak leaves on it. Like, it's just the art direction, the specificity, the care, each department working to, you know, write full chapters, it seemed, of Chip Driver's novel, you know? I mean, this doesn't happen on other shows. There's love in every department for the details and the lore. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah.
So I've sort of become a broken record about this. I think I've said this on previous episodes, but I'll say it again, which is just that what's important to understand is that Mike, sure, who created the show, probably doesn't know about 90% of the details that you just listed. Mm. And I think that explains why those details are there. Because when a lot of shows that are sort of run by like one kind of mad genius who sort of like has to put their hands in every little pot, and I've worked with those people and you probably have too, you know, what you end up having is everyone else kind of just like shuts down a little bit. You know, and they look to that person for all the answers, and that person wants to have all the answers, and it's very important, you know.
Yeah.
Mike just he trusts people. He says, I'm hiring you because you're good at your job. You're going to understand what's needed here. And it's so empowering that all the people And every department just give it their all, and they create their own little universes because they're empowered to. And, you know, it's the way every show should be run. I hope more people learn that lesson.
You're here. Frank, do you think that some of these discussions are had in meetings, or are these?
There's a lot of discussions and there's a lot of planning going on, but at the same time, it allows people to make a decision instead of like, what doily do you want? You know, and right. It's like, instead of like, why are we wasting time on this? I think this one looks great and it's going to match what should be Chidi's mother's doily, and, you know, and lets them go their direction instead of, you know, go and it's like, I need someone to tell me what doily to buy, you know? Right. So I agree. I mean, working with Eric and Matt in editorial, I mean, they bounce things off me and vice versa. And they, you know, when we're shooting ADR, they always come to help out in case there's a little bit of a rewrite that, you know, that needs to be picked up. And it's great. I mean, we're all covering each other and just making it better instead of making it different, which is sometimes, it sometimes happens in television. So,
Chidi is Chidi. Chidi can't choose a seat in the classroom. There's a fable on the board in both French and English. It's a fable known as The Crow and the Fox. And in another bit of torture or, you know, injection of doubt, it's a fable, the moral of which is effectively, not everyone has your best interest at heart, or don't believe everything you hear, or don't trust a flatterer. Like, that it's a bit of foreshadow that, you know, this
forking
show.
So I'm a parent of two young kids now. I've a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. And this whole idea, this whole episode kind of broke me.
Wow.
Because this idea that, you know, Chidi's parents didn't do anything particularly terrible. You know, they seemed like actually pretty good parents. They had a rough patch.
100%.
And in fact, when sort of approached by their young son with this idea of, you know, this presentation, they were faced with a choice. They were like, what do we do? Hey, let's just pretend that it worked. You mm-hmm. know, let's just pretend that like they convinced us, and we'll sort of tell this funny story like over the years, and it'll be cute. And like, that's not a bad decision. They had good intentions.
Right.
And that decision kind of destroyed Chidi. Like, it basically gave him too much power. As a right. child, he believed there's an answer, but also that like that the answer could really improve the world and improve people's lives and the lives of the family. And it just way too much weight and power to give to a kid. And it's just so sad to think that like you could be doing all the right things and still mess your kids up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have terrible news for you.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. I love that Chidi, you know, does this presentation. He does believe there's a wonderful allusion later to Chidi going, oh, I didn't know they went to counseling. And Michael says, yeah, they kids are idiots. They don't have any idea. Also, Chidi is a kid. So tagged on as an ancillary to this thing is like, also, we should probably get a dog. Like he's
yeah,
buying
right,
for.
Right. There's a really great stuff written on that blackboard. You should pause and
pretty great. Yeah. We flash forward and we find Chidi and his girlfriend and his parents having a dinner. There's an allusion to Professor Lindemann was a fool to give up on Chidi. Will, do you know what that's a reference to? I don't know if I know what that's a reference to.
No, I don't. I don't.
I do. So Will, in season one, I want to say the episode where you guys kill Janet for the first time, maybe like yeah. seven or so. There's a reference to one of your professors who you asked him to read, or Chidi asked him to read your thesis or your dissertation. He went out for a pack of cigarettes and never came back and left his right. tenured position at the Sorbonne.
That's right.
Oh my gosh. Thank
that
you for
was,
remembering
that. That was Professor Lindemann.
And thank so you for remembering
it's
that.
It's one of like our favorite little jokes in the and you delivered it so well. And so that we were just very pleased to work that back in.
That's right. I forgot about that. Yeah.
Your relationship is imperfect. Is her name Alessandra? I'm right about that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
She says we're not a book group, and Chidi says we're not a book group. Yeah. Chidi wants to find the answer to a problem. Alessandra is a kindred spirit in the sense that she wants to talk about David Hume, and she says reason is and ought only to be a slave to the passions. She then asks whether Chidi has any.
Yeah. His passions. Than books, you know, it's just, yeah. I mean, she's, you know, Alessandra's totally a kindred spirit in that way. But I think that you know, when you don't really see, when you see the computer working, but you don't necessarily see someone's heart in a person, that can, you know, I can only imagine that the passion really does just kind of disappear. You know, it's something that can be endearing at one point, but then, like, you know, eventually you kind of want to, you want to see the irrationality, you want to see the randomness, because that's the way the world is. And, you know, it's like, I feel like at some point, you know, Alessandro started to look at, you know, Chidi as a computer that took showers, and, you know, like,
yeah,
you know, that's not a basis on which to, that's not a person that you can really connect with. You know?
There's a great misdirect about passion, which is that it appears as though Chidi's about to prove his passion. Instead he goes to where normal people keep cookbooks, and he's got Kant over there to refute Hume's central theses. These two keep philosophy books in their kitchen. I presume that they live together. I don't know if that's the case or not. We get a great reference to a fork and a garbage disposal, which is a callback to the judge's chambers when, you know, Jason and Janet are having a moment and Chidi's, you know, overhearing it and applying it to his own life. It's the moment that spurs you to go and kiss Eleanor, right?
Yeah.
That results in the words, I think it's hot diggity dog. Is that her reaction to the case? We see Chidi in Australia.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Yeah, with his dissertation, it's 3,600 pages. Who we are and who we are not. Another lovely detail there is that the coffee cups, of which there are billions in this professor's office, are from We Crumb from a Land Down Under, another coffee cart we've seen in the show before. He says that that your dissertation, Chidi's dissertation, is an insane tangled web of inscrutability. And you say something along the lines of, like, in a fun way that we'll talk about forever. And he goes, no, in a unibomber, in a unibomber way. But Chidi fights the fight, right? Chidi's like, okay, I hear you. You're right. I'm going to go write a brief paper arguing that I should continue this much larger paper.
Yeah.
So crazy.
I'm not smart enough really to understand a lot of philosophy, but you know, we spent a lot of time in the editing room.
But you're fine with light being trucked in volume?
Okay. Barely understand
that. That's science.
So Mike, you know, sometimes Mike and I talk about philosophy a little bit because he understands it and I don't, and he dumbs it down for me. And so I'm going to dumb it down even further. But there is this central conflict in this whole episode between Kant and Hume.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, throughout Chidi's whole existence, Chidi is a Kantian. He's referenced Kant over and over again throughout the show. And Kant, essentially, as I understand it, was very black and white. He had a set of rules that you had to follow at all times. And one of the rules was that you should never lie. And that's one of the things that Chidi really believes in. And in fact, he was the one, I don't think this comes up in the show, but Kant was the guy that was like, if someone comes to your door and is like, I'm here to murder your brother, where is he? You have to say he's in the bedroom, which just seems a little bonkers. Hume was more of a kind of like, it's a little messier, you know, like we need to make room for passions and for human emotions and these things that don't fit into these neat little boxes. And so Chidi's journey in this episode seems to be all these people sort of like telling him, like, you have to accept the messiness of life. You have to accept that, like, there isn't a black and white answer, and him just saying no, 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 until the end. Sorry, I jumped ahead, but that's...
Well, that's all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's messy. It's complicated.
Right? Sure is.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Chidi does see the messiness, but I think he's dedicated to trying to find a thought process which can eliminate that.
Yeah,
you know, and at all costs, which it costs him literally everything.
Chidi in when we see Chidi and Uzo sharing a beer and trying to figure out the answer to his relationship with Alessandra, it's in the lifetime, it's in that period of time when you were not able to tell your coworker that you hated those red boots. So you are wearing those red boots.
Yeah.
It's pretty great. We then see your meeting with Michael, and Michael, in a delicious tiny bit of torture, offers you the choice of whether to come in or not, which we haven't seen before. And, you know, I think you even just get out the words like, it feels like you want me to, and he's like, it's fine, I'll do it. Which is failure. Like, for Chidi, that's a stomachache, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, what brings the most good to you in this moment, Michael? Do I stay right here and we have this conversation right here? Or do I come into your office? What do you need? And that's awful. Mm-hmm. What a terrible... I mean, like... Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, upon arriving in the afterlife, that's probably one of those things that he was hoping was going to be completely alleviated for him.
Choice-free. We're reminded briefly that the snap is still mid-snap. We cut back to the judges' chambers and, you know, more of the Midori Duval Ditchwaters flying out. Chidi goes to ask other people. We find out in these flashbacks, right after Jason and Janet's wedding, he goes to Jason for some advice, which is weird because, you know, Jason's Jason and Chidi's a high school principal. Oh, no, college professor. He gives advice that most things blow up when something dope comes around and you got to lock it down. If you're frozen in fear, you'll miss your opportunity. It's very sage advice coming from Jason Mendoza, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, also, look, he comes from a place where, you know, things explode. So, you know, it's like you might as well, like, just enjoy it before it blows up, which, you know, I mean, like, That totally makes sense, you know, because, you know, otherwise you're just watching explosions, just standing in the middle of them and never experiencing anything, except, you know, the experiencing watching things explode, which I guess is worthwhile, but that's not the point.
It's an allegory, I suppose, but his version of everything does have a correlate. I think he says at one point, like, you know, you do this, otherwise you might get sucked into the fan of a swamp boat or whatever.
Yeah,
there was that line actually continued. We had to cut it for a time.
But it was amazing.
I think it'll work. It will work it into an extended cut at some point. But Jason says, you know, or you might get sucked into the propeller of a swamp boat. I don't want to see you get sucked into the propeller of a swamp boat. I mean, I do want to see some things get sucked in the propeller of a swamp boat, like a cow, maybe, but not you.
Tahani also gives advice. What is it, Will? Chidi goes to Tahani and is like, how do you throw these parties? You do all this stuff. How do you know how it's going to work, right?
Yeah, and like you just swoop in with all this confidence and just, you know, just take over. And she's like, oh, yeah, well, you know, I definitely failed, you know, but I just kind of kept doing it. And, you know, I think that that's, you know, like even for me, Will, like, you know, there's things that I failed at really hard. And like the pain of that failure is something that I never want to replicate. And I mean, like, I remember, like, really, really pitiful side story. I actually did try stand up one time. And the feeling of bombing was so bad. Bad. And I was like, you know, it's like, I'm a performer already. I don't need to have my confidence shake in a performing forum. I really don't need that. And so I, like, I've never done it again. I never want to do it again. And I will not. But it was, you know, but it is like a lesson where it's just like, you know, it's like it doesn't always work out, but you have to improvise. Sure. And if something is worth it, you know, like, you know, you go in with the confidence of the things that you know, and then you learn along the way. But you just can't expect to have all the answers or expect everything to work out exactly the way it's supposed to. You just have to be open to some disorder and sort of adjusting on the fly.
And the lesson is that you are going to fail. That's a given. That's 100% certain. What you do with that is what matters, right? If you realize that failure is not a permanent fatal condition, Except, you know, perhaps in the instance of a fan of a swamp boat, that's permanent. Let's be clear on this podcast and outward that's a lasting situation.
There's just this really beautiful idea nestled in this show about cynicism versus hope, you know, and like the idea that Michael, the demon version of Michael, in his cynical way, he imagined the best way to torture people would be to get people who are kind of like designed to annoy the
shit
out of each other and put them together, and that's like going to be torture forever. But there's also this really hopeful idea that like we actually all have something to offer one another if we'll kind of just get past ourselves somehow and like figure out how to like, you know, ask for help and that kind of thing. And it's I guess there's no way to make that not sound cheesy, but man, we should all just like get over ourselves and like
confess you don't know
yeah,
all the answers
and just ask for some help and just like talk to more people. I don't know, listen and like, you know, like meet your neighbors.
Brent. He's not scared. He's yelling to let you know that he's okay.
Yeah.
We meet some of Chidi's soulmates, Celibacia, Guan Yin, Tahani in one thing. Karen, we meet Esmeralda, played by Kate Berland. If there were ever an indication that you're not in the good place, I feel like that game night should have been it, right? She brings.
Yeah.
She must away and attend to her ravens. I mean, should have been an indication.
Yeah. Knives. Mm-hmm. She brought knives. You know, that's the thing. That's it's pretty amazing how also, though, you know, it's like I think that, you know, there is an aspect to this, which is things are supposed to be a certain way, which means that, you know, even if there's indications that this is absolutely wrong, you know, there must be some sort of cosmic reason for this person to be my soulmate.
Right.
And so it's like, in an interesting way, it's like, you know, it's like one of the odd ways in which Chidi sort of goes with the flow. Dismissed. It's still like, you know, this is a person that I'm supposed to be with. I mean, maybe 100 years down the road, that's the person that I'm supposed to be, you know, or she changes into something that I recognize more fully. You know, it's just, but it goes back to that sort of rigidity, which there are rules. And
I suppose it's an interesting thing that the show posits about soulmates that, you know, they're probably not real. They're made. But boy, oh boy, Chidi and Eleanor keep finding each other in all these reboots and all these scenarios. It happens after Tahani's game night that Eleanor, you know, selfishly asked to meet Chidi because she realizes that she immediately needs to learn ethics to become a better person to stay there. But they have a connection and she kisses him. And that's one very interesting scene because that's a scene that I can remember in the gag reel, you two playing like Slap My Hands in that setup, I think. This was retooled, right? You didn't shoot this last season. You recreated it for this little bit, for this kiss. It's kind of an interesting, you know, these two are sort of cosmically drawn to one another, it feels like. So whether it's soulmates or not, it's maybe these are the soulmates that are made. They get together and it gets worked on, and there are good times and there are bad times. We see all this in these things. We see Chidi's office back in season two Australia. We're behind the bar at the Puking Moose. You're in Janet's void as the universe is crumbling. We see you back at the screening of the clip show, The Memories You May Have Forgotten, which brings us to this. Let's listen to a clip.
Can I ask you a question? Soulmates aren't real, are they?
Chidi, in all honesty, I don't know, but I don't think so. I knew what you expected to find when you got here, answers. Also, if I recall from your file, a magic blackboard?
One that anticipates your lesson flow. That's the dream.
But mostly you wanted answers. The soulmate one in particular. So I used it to torture you. Which, again, sorry. If soulmates do exist, they're not found. They're made. People meet, they get a good feeling, and then they get to work building a relationship. Like your parents. They didn't magically stay together because you proved they should.
It wasn't my logic or my presentation. It was the feeling they got watching me, this scared little kid, telling them that he needed them.
And it was also what you made them remember. You know, they loved each other. Sometimes people forget. You reminded them of what they already had. It convinced them to go to counseling.
I never knew they went to counseling.
Yeah, kids are idiots. They knew half the stuff their folks were up to, they'd lose their minds.
Turns out life isn't a puzzle that can just be solved one time and it's done. You wake up every day and you solve it again.
Terribly inefficient.
What a time to learn. Can you give me a second?
It's a lovely little scene, Will. Talk a little bit about that that interaction with Ted.
There's this thing that, you know, Eleanor brings up in Chidi, which is just sort of straight sort of reactionary passion. And sometimes it comes out in the form of an argument and you know, just sort of like, why would you think that that's rational or fair? Or, you know, or it's, you know, just this impulse to just kiss her, you know? Mm-hmm. And like seeing, like walking away and seeing Eleanor sitting there in that little courtyard, like all by herself. It's a really heartbreaking thing, just because, you know, here's this person that I've finally been able to actually connect with on a very passionate level. And so, you know, it's like there's something that she brings out in me that has never been there, you know, that I never knew was there. And I'm leaving her, you know, and that's awful. That's awful. I'm like, really, I'm letting her down in order to pursue the mission that we've set before ourselves. And so it's really, I don't know. It was like a really, that scene was like, it was a really emotionally raw place. And also really cathartic to actually get the answers, to hear someone say that these things that are preordained and orderly, they aren't that.
Right.
And also for me, just looking back and seeing Eleanor, you know, which I don't think she was actually there on the day, but I just keep thinking of that image from the finale last year, which just broke my heart. And, you know, just like that image just sort of kept popping into my head. I'm leaving this person that has sort of completely unknowingly answered a lot of things for me.
Mm. You summon Janet, you ask her for a pen and some paper. You write yourself a note, which is a nice bit of closure to Eleanor writing herself a note. Eleanor find Chidi on the front page of What We Owe to Each Other. I texted with Darcy about this because Janet kissing your cheek, it's, Janet has become very human. And beyond Janet, I can feel what Darcy's feeling. Darcy confessed that was, she said you and Ted were killing her that night, just bringing her to tears, and that getting through that was very difficult.
Yeah. You know what my favorite thing about Darcy is, like, whenever she's, because she's super empathetic.
Yeah.
And so, like, when she starts to cry, which happens often, it's like she just does this thing where she just looks up at the sky and tries to put the tears back into her head.
She does do that. Yes. She's doing. You're right.
It's the most endearing thing. It's such a vulnerable, like almost childlike reaction.
You're right about
to
that.
Emotion watching over you. It's like, if I can just put the tears back, let me just put them back.
I've never thought of it in those terms, and you're exactly right. She tips her head to the sky as though to say, like, they'll go back in. They'll go back in.
Yeah.
There were a couple takes in that scene where her eyes were dry, and I chose one of the ones where her eyes were wet, and I presented it to Mike, and I said, you know, this
Darcy's
is
crying.
Darcy crying.
Yeah.
But it feels so real. It feels so, you know, it feels like Janet has gotten to that place emotionally and, you know, she can do it. And even though it's Darcy crying, I feel like it's also Janet crying. And he was like, yep, yeah, good.
Wow. I mean, that's the thing you're talking about, Frank, about like decisiveness. Like, no, like, oh, what does it mean? What does it mean? You know, stomach ache, cheaty, cheaty. Like,
yeah.
Mike, I feel like, is a person that we've heard lots and lots on the show, is decisive and says, that works.
Yeah.
You know? Kind of incredible.
I just have to have Will, how did he, the shot, the Kubrick-esque shot of Chidi's eyes closed when they're going around, I remember watching it on the mix stage, and I think I spent 5 minutes trying to do that and feel my, if I could get my pupils to move around. And it was, I don't know, it just, it keeps, I was even thinking of that on the way in today, but I didn't try to practice it while I was driving.
While you're driving?
But,
Is that training, Will, or...
Yeah. I mean, that's really what I got my made. That's what I got my degree in.
That makes sense.
Twitching.
Yeah. I'm twitching. It's awesome. It's awesome.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
This entire episode, again, happens within the duration of one snap of Michael's fingers. We see tons of images. I want to ask about a kiss that happens, and because it's something that we've seen before. I think it's in the season 3 finale. But how did you choose, Eric, where those images came from? You've got 4 seasons of show to choose from. The little snippets, what went into that? Those 1,000 decisions?
Funny story. So we like doing like little Easter eggs in the show. I think we've talked about this on the podcast before.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a few lost, the TV show Lost Easter eggs. Mm-hmm. There's been a leftovers Easter eggs. Basically shows that both shows that we like and shows that sort of have influenced the show in some way. And one of the shows that we spend an inordinate amount of time talking about is Game of Thrones. In the script for this section, it says Michael snaps his fingers and we see a quick flash of images of Chidi's memories. And they did this sequence in Game of Thrones where a character has a vision and you see this like flash of crazy images. And I was like, my little editing Easter egg is I'm going to take that sequence, I'm going to rip it from the episode and I'm going to recreate it frame for frame in The Good Place. You know, and I had this whole thing and I spent like way too much time on it. And I presented this idea to Mike and I said, what do you think? And he's like, I love it. It's great. Do it. And so I did it, spent way too much time on it. And then I show it to Mike and he's like, oh, you know what? The problem is that in this section, we really should be only showing memories from this part of the show. And you're sort of showing memories from all over. Like you've got Sean in here. And I'm like, yeah, but Sean's the Night King.
But my very funny thing.
But Sean's the Night King. And he's like, right, okay. But, you know, just change it. And I'm like, okay, fine. And then we're like a week goes by and we're trying to get time out of the episode because the episode's a little long. And he's like, well, just cut down that first memory thing. And I'm like, but it's the game, it's frame accurate. And he's like, okay, come on, let's just not the point. So the whole point of the story is that Mike, people talk on the show a lot on this episode, on this podcast about how Mike makes the show so great and so much better. But in this case, he definitely made it worse. he just ruined that idea and I'll never forgive him for it.
Sure. Your time together is coming to a close as it stands.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. It leads us to a place where Chidi wakes up and is maybe as relaxed as we've ever seen him. I think you say, man, I'm doing great. Which is a very non-Chidi thing. And then Chidi, you know, is all the wiser. Eleanor asks him for the answer. And he says, what, Will? There could be 800 answers?
It could be 800. It could be one. Who knows? The journey is the destination, right?
Amazing.
Yeah.
Then you ask Janet for the note. And you see some Darcy in this Janet. She says, if you remember that you wrote a note, then you know what it says. And you said, it might be some of the best writing I've ever done. And then we see that the note's folded and tries in a great way to reveal that the first line is, there is no answer, in quotes. And then you open the second part of it and it says, but Eleanor is the answer. I was telling Frank and Eric before we began recording today that I will never forget being at the table read for this. Mike reads that because it's stage direction. It's not dialogue. Mike Schur at the end of the show said, there is no answer, but Eleanor is the answer. And I remember looking directly across at co-producer Doug Smith, who's in tears at the moment, as am I, as is in the entire room.
And for everyone who doesn't know Doug Smith, he's not really like a teary
guy. No, he's like a... a very nice person.
I mean, but like, very, I mean,
he's not given. He's not Darcy.
No.
It's a lovely moment, Will. What do you remember about that last scene in the judges' chambers?
You know, it's, well, I just remember the look on KB's face. I mean, I gotta say, it's like, you know, there's something about that alley, Flower Alley, where mm-hmm. I always fall a little bit more in love with Kristen Bell. Like, like every time we're in that alley, it's always just like something about the atmosphere and also just, you know, Kristen Bell that just makes me be like, yo, like, let's just run away right now. But I just remember looking over at KB at that moment, and it's just such a hard shell that has been sort of chipped away over these past 3.5 years. And, you know, to see that I'm the person that she feels okay being vulnerable with, like, that's a gift, yeah. You know? And
like 40 things happen in that take, right? You read the note. You look over at her, she looks at you like with an innocence as if to say, what does it say? And then she melts into, God, I love that guy. And then it sort of morphs into, he's going to do it. He's going to change. Yeah. He's going to figure out a new afterlife. I mean, it's she does like 5 things in 3/8 of 1 second.
That is Kristen's like superpower. Well, I mean, she has many superpowers, one of which is eating, chewing gum and acting.
That's crazy to me.
But her superpower, and I've never seen it in another actress, is like being able to hold 3 emotions at once and switch between them in the blink of an eye. It's crazy.
When we were mixing that scene of the flower alley, though, it's like, I remember we did the playback on Saturday, and I'm just like, oh my God, this is not good, because it's like we have nothing to hide. There's no background sounds that we hide, and I just wanted to hear it so crisp and clean, and we're listening on the big speakers. I'm just like, oh, it's not good, but it was so great, just because I just wanted some way to make it better, but there really wasn't much you could put on top of it. It was pretty much the best Sunday already.
My goodness.
Yeah, that was also one of those, it's like a hyperverbal scene that I was like really worried that, God, man, I don't want to be in my head. I don't want to be sort of like thinking of the next line a little bit. You know, it's like this is a scene that really needs to feel settled. We need to feel,
referring to the scene of, take those in order. It was a kiss. It was me, weirdo. And all right, kiss rescinded, that whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just remember like, I think I had shot a lot that day, and it was like the end of the day. And I was, you know, I had a lot of lines in my head over the course of that day. And I was just like, oh God, I really don't want to like tank this scene, you know? And it was one of those scenes where we read it once and it just went in. There's something about the writing of that particular scene, which is as nuanced and specific as it was, it was effortless to just sort of be there.
Amazing.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Eric Kissack, what's good?
I'm really into trees.
Mm.
I think trees are cool. They're pretty, and they help heal the earth. So I'm really into this charity called One Tree Planted, onetreeplanted.org.com. I don't know. Google it. One Tree Planted. And it's great. You just give them money and they plant trees. And they plant trees in California and Peru and Indonesia and all over the world. And it's like if you care about the environment and the, you know, want the world to get slightly better and want to do something with your money, I think that's a great, great thing to do.
OneTreePlanted.org.
Boom.
Frank Sackett, what's good?
Besides this show and all the people on it, I'm pretty lucky to have 2 little daughters that keep me honest, and a wife that puts up with me, and you know, I've met some great friends on the show that I hope to keep for a while. And, you know, they've helped me in my career, and hopefully I've helped them a little bit. So there you go.
Well done. William Jackson Harper, what's good?
Well, I'm gonna bring us way down into the gutter here. But actually, it's pretty great. There's this really great video of this ballet class with these little girls and their dads, and they're doing this these little duet dances together, and it's the best thing I've seen in a very long time. Just absolutely melted my heart. But it's just like this ballet class with you know, these grown men and their little daughters, and they're just taking ballet together.
I just found it. I know what you're talking about, but just by typing in ballet dads, it's the first thing to come up on YouTube or the New York Post. It's worth it. This has been The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. Thank you for listening. You live through the failure and you learn from it. Now go do something good.
Well, Good Place stands. That's one more episode in the books.
Wow, you're using the word stand now?
Yeah, I'm hip. Would a not hip person be shipping Chidi and Eleanor this hard?
I told you, Michael, stay away from youth culture. It's not for you.
But I like talking like this, fam.
Oh boy, you listeners can't see him right now, but he is definitely dabbing.
Oh yeah.
Gotta go. See you next time, Good Place the podcast listeners. We stand you back.
Wait up. The Good Place, the podcast, is hosted by Mark Evan Jackson.
Produced by Grant Rutter.
Edited and produced by Trey Booty.
Booty. Written and produced by Lizzie Pace.
Later.
Okay.